Might be remembering this. The Columbine High School in Columbine, Colorado, where two gunmen walked into the school and they started killing innocent people. I still remember, I was pretty young, but I still remember some of the video of watching, you know, the newscast and seeing just some of the massacre that went on. Up until December, it was one of the biggest school shootings that America had ever seen, until Sandy Hook Elementary, just a few months ago. As some of the innocent people were taking shelter, there was a group that kind of huddled together in the school library. And one of the girls, or one of the killers, pulled one of the girls aside. He walked in with his gun, pulled this girl aside, and her name was Cassie. And they knew each other. And he looked Cassie in the eye, and she looks right at him, and she's crying. She's trembling, obviously. They have just watched friends die by the hand of these gunmen. And he looks at her and he asks her a simple question. He says, "Do you believe in God?" What would you do in that moment? Staring down the barrel of a gun, staring at what might be your killer's face, and he asks you, "Do you believe in God?" You answer correctly, you could live. You can have a wonderful life. You can have friends. You can have family. You can get married someday. You can watch your kids walk down the aisle of their wedding. You answer wrong, and your life's over. The students that were huddled together with her that are watching this transpire, they told news reporters later that they kind of saw Cassie look down for just a second, no doubtingly questioning, "What do I say here?" And as she looked back up, they said she kind of stood up, puffed up her chest, and said, "Yes, I do." And with that, the gunman pulled the trigger. Cassie died that day. This is an encouraging story of a young person who was a junior in high school, about the age 16, 17 years old, who was so strong in her faith that she could literally stare death in the face. She could look at her killer and still take her stand for Jesus. I think many of us would like to think that we would do the same thing. I mean, if someone were to ask me, if someone pointed to put a gun to your head, that's what we say, right? If someone put a gun to your head, would you do it? We would like to say, "Yeah, I would still say I believe in God." That's easy, right? But is it really that easy? Because I think most of us, myself included, would probably be so scared, I'd probably want to just save my own life. You know, that reminds me of someone in the Bible. Reminds me of Peter. Where Peter, here's someone that followed Jesus, someone that loved Jesus, who tried to stand up for Jesus time and time and time again. But when it really came down to it, he wasn't really ready to give up his life to stand up for Jesus. I mean, he was to the point that said, "Jesus, I'm going to go with you wherever you go. Why can't we go yet? I'm going to go with you." And when the mob came to arrest Jesus that night, remember, he was the one that pulled out a sword. He was ready to fight, and Jesus said, "Put your sword away." And then when it really came down to it, you know, I liken him to these people that say, "Oh yeah, I can stare death in the face, and I can still say I believe in God." But when it really came down to it, and he was warming himself around this coal fire, and people were saying, "You know what, you look familiar. Aren't you, you're a follower of Jesus, aren't you?" "No, you got the wrong guy. Wrong, not me, right? Not me. No, this is a relative of the person's ear you cut off. He would know that this is you. You're a follower of Jesus." "No, you have the wrong person. That's not me." That's what I think I would do, if I'm going to be honest. That I would probably be more like Peter. When it really came down to it, if my life was on the line, I would look my killer in the face and say, "You got the wrong person. It's not me." I commend Cassie because she was able to really, I mean, when I was reading what these other friends saw as they watched her, this little conversation transpire in the library, they said she looked down, looked back up, and kind of stood up. And she knew what was about to come. She was able to stand up tall, stand up in her faith, and give the correct answer. I wonder how many of us would have that same attitude. If I were to ask you today, why do you believe in God? What would your answer be? Why can't you participate in certain activities with friends or family members that you know are sinful? What if someone were to come up to you at school or in the workplace and say, why is being a Christian so important to you? How would you answer some of these questions? We looked at yesterday, especially in the standing up to friends portion, where 50% of young people are being asked these questions by their friends, and they don't know how to give an answer, and so they just decide to go along with their friends, and 50% of young people are falling away from the church today because they are not ready to give an answer for their faith. They're not ready to stand up for their faith. And I think more than 50% would, if having a gun held to their head, answer that they didn't know or they didn't believe in God if their life depended on it. How do we deal with these questions? How do we stand firm in our faith when our world is trying to destroy it? How do we stand firm in our faith when everyone else around us doesn't hold the same faith we have? How do we stand firm in the faith when it seems like I'm the only one left that would believe in God? And how do I deal with all these outside activities and all these outside influences so I can make sure that I'm not like Peter, and I'm more like Cassie. And we'll see some other Bible characters that were, that should I say Cassie was like, not they were like Cassie. First off, I want to look at this question. What is faith? If we had to look at faith, this says it's on, but it's not. There's another clicker in that back room. Can you, I think this ran out of battery. If we had to look at what faith was, the biblical definition is there in Hebrews chapter 11 and in verse 1. And it's the definition that everyone gives when they say, well, what is faith? What is faith? If I had to ask you, what is faith, based on the biblical definition, what would you say? Right there in verse 1. This is the answer everyone gives, right? Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence. Things not seen. What does that mean? That's the cookie cutter answer that people will give. What is faith? It's the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Okay. Okay, something you cannot see or grasp. Many people grapple with what this means because this is a, if you grew up in the church, you've heard this explained, and that's all great and dandy, but a lot of people have never read that verse before. And so you thank you so much. There we go. A lot of people have never read this verse before. And so when you give them this biblical answer of faith, they have nothing to compare this to and nothing to really hold on to. But I make this point a lot to the members here that the biblical writers never tell us something without further explaining it. They never leave us to wonder. And many times we stop at verse 1 and we say, well, that's the definition of faith, but we don't keep reading. And in verse 2 there, let's read verses 2 and 3 of Hebrews chapter 11. So we know what faith is. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Okay. For by it the elders obtained a good testimony. We're going to look at that in just a minute, but verse 3, by faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God so that the things which are seen were not made of things which are visible. You know, when we look at the world today, the world is all about proof, right? Where's the proof? Where's the evidence? Where are the cold hard facts that I can put my hands on and I can see so that I can know for sure that this is real? We want facts. We want the evidence. If you can't see it, touch it, hear it, smell it, or taste it, it can't be real. Right? Let me ask you, have you ever seen God? Seen God. Have you ever touched God? Has God ever stood right in front of you? Have you been able to? Like Thomas, remember? He said, I'm not going to believe until I can stick my fingers in the holes of his hand and stick my hand up his side. I won't believe until I can touch him and I can see him in front of me. Have you ever done that? No, I have. This might sound weird, but have you ever smelled God or tasted God? I have. Have you ever heard God? Has he ever just spoken directly to you like Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? Not me. This is the problem with the world today. They want evidence. They want cold, hard facts. They want to be able to touch, to see, to hear, to smell, and to taste what is really in this world. And when we say, well, we haven't been able to do that with God, then they say, then how do you know? Then he's obviously not real. But Hebrews 11 verse 3 says we can look out at the world, we can look at the things that are around us, and we can see that they were framed by God. Now, I've never physically seen God standing here, but I can look out at the world and I can see God. Romans 1 says that, doesn't it? That the invisible attributes of God are clearly seen. A lot of people read over that verse and they understand what it says, but do you understand the irony of what that says? The invisible attributes of God are clearly seen. How can something that's invisible be clearly seen? Right? In other words, Paul's trying to say in Romans, these things that you could see in the world, they help you see the unseen. They help you see God in a way that, well, yeah, he's not physically right here, but he's in this world. And that's why I love these first few verses in Hebrews 11. And that's why we cannot stop at verse 1 when we say, what is faith? Because many people don't know what that definition is. Hebrews 11:3 says we can look out at the world, see that they were framed by God. These things that we see were made of things we cannot see. And that's just an amazing thing. And I saw this illustration on Facebook about a week or two ago, and some of you may have seen this too, so if you saw it, just kind of go along with it, because it's been kind of trending on Facebook. But this is a good example. What if you were hiking in the woods and you walk up on a car in the woods? How did it get there? How did it get there? Someone drove it? You're wrong. Did you see who drove it? Did you see who drove it? No. Did you see who made the car? No. Here's what science would say. You didn't see who put the car in the woods, and you have no evidence of who touched the car, and you can't touch the person who put the car there, you can't taste the person, you can't smell the person, you can't see the person. So obviously, that car was not put there by somebody, right? Now some of you are smiling, thinking, that's ridiculous. No, what science will say is, what's happened over millions and millions of years is the tectonic plates under the Earth's crust have slowly started to push some iron out of the ground, and it started to form itself. And then what happened are some rubber trees sprouted up. Have you seen this, Josh? Some rubber trees have sprouted up, and then a fire happened, and it melted down into perfect circles around this iron that's already been formed. Some animals decided to take a rest inside this perfectly formed piece of iron, and when they died, they left their skins behind. And they slowly started to wrap themselves over millions of years around this the cotton that had already been put in. And so now you have these fluffy seats. And isn't that what science tries to do with the world? And a lot of you are laughing at this illustration, but that's what they say. The world is here. And you can't see, touch, smell, taste, or hear who put the world here. But here's what happened. Let me explain to you what happened. Over millions and millions of years, all these things just slowly came together. And the Hebrew writer, and Paul in Romans, is trying to say, listen, we can look at something like this, like a car in the woods, and you know that this just didn't happen. So what happened? Who made this? Well, based on the little logo at the front of that car, some Honda makers, right? Who believes in Honda makers here? Honda, what do you call them, engineers? You guys ever met a Honda engineer? No? Have you ever talked to a Honda engineer? Have you ever smelled? I don't want to know what they smell like. Then how do you know Honda engineers exist? How do you know? Because what you could see on that car suggests that someone you can't see made this, right? The evidence is there. That's what faith is talking about here. That the unseen, or the seen attributes, the evidence that you can see, all points back to something you can't see. That's God. Just like the Honda engineers. We can't see them, but we know they're there. And that's what we look at faith. And let me add this to faith. Faith is not just believing in something you can't see, but knowing without a doubt that the unseen exists. Because some people, and there is a difference. Some people say, well, I believe in God. I believe in God, but I don't really know if he's there. You know what I'm saying? Is that faith? Faith is, okay, I believe in God, and I know without a doubt that he exists. I have no question in my mind that he exists, and I believe in him. When I think of Cassie on that day in the Columbine shooting, I think of someone that had that mentality. I know he is there. I believe in him, and I know without a doubt that he exists. I'm not afraid of what will happen to me. I know that God is there, and he will take care of me. That's what we're going to see here going forward in Hebrews chapter 11. Let me ask you this question. Is believing good enough? Is having faith good enough? Because many people in the world today have faith, right? You can talk to friends at school. You can talk to friends at work. And, yeah, I believe in God. I believe, and I know he's there, and that's good enough for me. Is it? I see a lot of people kind of shaking their heads no. I know a lot of people who believe in God. I know a lot of people who say that they're Christians. I know a lot of people who say that they know God is there and they know God is living today. Most of those people, majority of those people, close to all of those people, still live sinful lives, even though they believe in God. Can you live a sinful life and make it into heaven without being obedient to God? Now, listen, we're all sinners. We all have sin in our lives. But if God is not in our lives and we're not obedient to God, we can't make it to heaven. Which tells me that believing in God, there's something more than to just believing in God. We can't believe in God and still decide to do whatever we want to do. When you look at all the great Bible characters, what sets them apart from everyone else was that they let their faith dictate their actions. What made Abraham so great? What made David so great? What made Peter, Paul, Moses, Ruth, Naomi, Esther? I mean, all these people that we can read about, men and women, young and old, what made them so great? They put their faith into action. We're going to read a good part of Hebrews chapter 11, and I want you to notice a few things. If you can, keep track of how many times the term by faith or through faith is used as we read. And then, if you can also keep track of how many times a verb follows that phrase. Okay? Hebrews chapter 11, let's start reading in verse 4. We've already read 1 through 3. Let's start reading in verse 4. By faith, Abel offered to God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain, through which he obtained witness that he was righteous, God testifying on his gifts, and through it, he being dead, still speaks. By faith, Enoch was taken away so that he did not see death and was not found because God had taken him. For before he was taken, he had his testimony that he pleased God. But without faith, it is impossible to please him, for he who comes to God must believe that he is and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. By faith, Noah, being divinely warned of things not yet seen, moved with godly fear, he prepared an ark for the saving of the household, and by which he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness which is according to faith. By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to the plain, which he would receive as an inheritance. And he went out, not knowing where he was going. By faith, he dwelt in the land of promise as in a foreign country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. By faith, Sarah herself received strength to conceive seed. She bore a child when she was past her age, because she judged him faithful who had promised. Let's skip down to verse 17. By faith, Abraham, when he was testified, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises of offered up his only begotten son. Of him it was said, in Isaac your seed shall be called, concluding that God was able to raise him up, even from the dead, from which he had also received him in a figurative sense. By faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau concerning things to come. By faith, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph in worship, leaning on the top of his staff. By faith, Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the departure of the children of Israel and gave instructions concerning his bones. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden 3 months by his parents because they saw he was a beautiful child, and they were not afraid of the king's command. By faith, Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he looked to the reward. By faith, he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. By faith, he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of the blood, lest he who destroyed the firstborn should touch them. By faith, they passed through the Red Sea as by dry land, whereas the Egyptians attempting to do so were drowned. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after they were encircled for 7 days. By faith, the harlot Rahab did not perish with those who did not believe when she had received the spies with peace. And what more shall I say, for the time would fail me to tell you of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah and also David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, became valiant in battle, turned to flight the armies of the aliens, women received their dead raised to life again. Others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. How many by faith or through faith did anyone count? Anyone try to keep track? Okay, I got 18, so we'll shoot right there in the middle. Someone said 17, I heard 19. I got 18. How many of those were followed by a verb? Every single one is followed by they did something. By faith, and then they did something with their faith. I like that little, I'm a sports guy, so I know Nike, their tagline is just do it. And there you have it, made into a cross, and the guy's carrying his cross. Just do it. Which meant get busy, right? You have to do something with your faith. These people, the people we just read about, and even the Hebrew writer said, time will fail me to tell you about all these other people that I could tell you about and the faith and what they've done. These people let their faith in God tell them what they should do, how they should talk, how they should dress, where they should go, who they should be with. Their faith in God was the motivating factor for everything they did. In fact, many of these people wouldn't do something without first asking God for help or advice. David did that before he went into battle. Lord, tell me where I should go. Lord, should I go take this army? Lord, should I do this? It's just incredible to look at this chapter and say, look at how many times it says, by faith. By faith, they were able to do these great and extraordinary things. By faith, they were able to do all these wonderful things. Let me ask you this question. What is stopping you and what is stopping me from being exactly like these heroes of the Bible? My answer would be our faith. What's stopping us from being like Joseph, who was able to keep his faith in God, and who was able to forgive his brothers, and who was able to overcome adversity? What's stopping us from being like Timothy, who was able to preach and teach the truth when people were despising his youth? What's stopping us from being like people like Titus, or David, or Daniel, or Ruth, Lydia, Peter, Paul, Rahab, Moses, Noah, and all the other great men and women of the Bible? Why can't we be like them? I was talking the other day with a few people, and we said, you know, unfortunately, what we do in the world today is we take these great men and women of faith, and we think of them as old crotchety men with beards and a cane walking around the desert somewhere who are perfect. Josh brought this up in his sermon on Friday night. These people are not perfect. These people have flaws. They have faults. They need help. But yet they are the ones written down in this book for people to study about and to learn from. Why? Because they let their faith overrule everything else in their life. We put these people up on a pedestal, and I think rightfully so in some circumstances, because they are the mothers and fathers of faith, if we want to call them that. But they are not perfect by any means. They are just like you, and they're just like me. They're imperfect people trying to live in an imperfect world. They're trying to do what's best for God, trying to do what's best for their family, trying to do what's best for themselves, and they mess up sometimes. They weren't perfect at all. They sin. Some of them are some drastic sins, if we want to rank them. But yet they're mentioned here in Hebrews 11. And we call it the Hall of Faith, don't we? Or the Hall of Fame of Faith. But these people weren't perfect. I really think you and I can be just like these great men and women of the Bible. The only way to accomplish that, the only way that I see to accomplish that, based on God's word, is to allow our faith in God, to allow that undeniably, that undeniable evidence that God exists to lead us in our actions. In other words, once I believe in God and I have that faith that I know the unseen exists, which I think we all have or else we wouldn't be here this morning, what am I doing to put that faith into action? What am I doing to take that stand so that if someone held a gun to my head, I could boldly stand up and say, yeah, I believe in him, and I don't care what comes of me. That's what I see in these characters. That's what made these characters so special. They gave up everything to follow God and to please God. Turn with me to James chapter 1. Keep your finger in Hebrews 11. We're going to come back there in just a few moments. But in James chapter 1, James 1 and verse 22. Let's back up to verse 21. Therefore, lay aside all filthiness and overflow of wickedness, and receive with meekness the implanted word, which is able to save your souls. But be doers of the word, and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. For if anyone is a hearer of the word, and not a doer, he is like a man observing his natural face in a mirror. For he observes himself, goes away, and immediately forgets what kind of man he was. But he who looks into the perfect law of liberty, and continues in it, and is not a forgetful hearer, but a doer of the work, this one will be blessed in what he does. That's a perfect contrast between the two people I was talking about a few moments ago. Where you have people who claim to be Christian. You have people who claim to believe in God. A lot of our friends and family members believe in God. And they might have faith in God. But is faith good enough? That's what I think James is saying here. Don't merely be a hearer of the word. If you're someone that just hears the word and you say, yeah, I agree with it, I believe in God, I understand this to be true, but you don't do anything with it, he says you're like a person that just looks in the mirror and forgets what he sees as soon as he walks away. How many of you have ever looked in the mirror and more? I hope all of us looked in the mirror this morning. Maybe some of you didn't. And then immediately when you turn away, you have to stop and go back. What do I look like? I forgot. He says, but a doer of the word is like someone who can look into the law of liberty, stare wholeheartedly into the law of liberty, and wants to apply these things to his life. We can do that. We can be a doer of the word instead of just a hearer only. Jesus tells us in Matthew chapter 16, Matthew 16 and verse 24, then Jesus said to his disciples, if anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. That's why I kind of put that picture up there. You know, a lot of people are willing to follow Jesus. A lot of people are willing to follow Jesus because they believe in Jesus. How many of us are willing to deny ourselves, take up our cross, and follow him? There's three verbs there that we need to do. And notice again that if we're going to have faith, it's followed by verbs or action. He says, if you believe in me, okay, which I don't think any of us would argue with. We believe in him. He says, and you need to do a few things. You need to deny yourself. You need to take up your cross and you need to follow me. He gives us three verbs to do. Jesus had the same mentality of faith is not good enough. You need to put this faith into action. We can go into a lot of detail on this. Almost every parable Jesus gives, he talks about putting this into action. My favorite, we went over this a couple weeks ago in my adult class here that I'm teaching. We talked about the Good Samaritan, and twice Jesus says, go and do likewise, which means don't just hear this parable and learn a fun little story, and don't just say, well, yeah, we understand we need to be nice to those people around us. He says, now I want you to take what you've learned and then go do it. Right? We need to put our faith into action. Putting your faith into action, there's a couple things you need to understand about this. Sometimes the results aren't what we are going to expect. Sometimes putting your faith into action is hard. Look back at the story we told at the beginning of Cassie. She put her faith into action, and guess what? She might have got the results she expected, but that's a tough pill to swallow, right? You go through that list of Hebrews 11. How many of them, when they put their faith into action, were rewarded handsomely in this world for doing what they did in life? Think of all the characters. How many of them were praised by their peers and praised by the kings of the land or whatever it is? Almost none of them. Because when they took a stand for God and took a stand for their faith, sometimes the results aren't what they expected. And it was hard. And in fact, we got into it just a little bit there in verse 35. When it's in Hebrews 11, if you want to flip back there. These are people who took their stand for faith, and they believed in God, and they followed God wholeheartedly. But it says there in verse 35, women received their dead, raised to life again. Okay. But then he kind of switches tones here a little bit, and he says, others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. Still, others had trials of mockings and scourgings, yes, and of chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, were tempted, were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, and tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and mountains, in dens and caves of the earth. Let me tell you, or let me ask you, how many of you would want that life? How many of you, if I said, listen, I got a great deal for you today. If you stand up in your faith for God, and if you do what God wants you to do, the reward is you might be stoned, you might be sawn in two, you might be thrown in prison, and you might have to spend the rest of your life in prison. You might have to give up everything you've ever loved, and you might have to give up your family. And, you know, you might be killed. You might not be killed. There's a possibility you might not be. But you're going to probably live a pretty dismal life. Wandering around the desert, living in caves. How many of you would sign up for that activity? Sign up now and you get bonus points, right? No, I'm kidding. So let me ask you this. Why stand up in your faith? If standing up in your faith could bring on all these things, why do it? Why? Because any normal person, let's face it, any normal person will look at this list and say, this is happening to the people who follow God? Why do I want that? Don't think that just because things are going to be don't think that just because you believe in God, things are going to be easy. Sometimes, as faithful Christians, you will have to go through some very difficult circumstances because you believe in God. Sometimes, you will have to go through the loss of a family member. Sometimes, you will have to go through a sickness, whether it's you or someone that you love. Sometimes, you will have to go through a job loss. Sometimes, you will be made fun of at school for believing in Jesus or believing in God. Sometimes, people will think you're weird for believing in God. We talked about that yesterday as well. It's okay to be weird if you believe in God. You may not get invited to parties. Some good people will suffer because they have decided to believe in God. But we need to remember one thing. This world here is not our home. We're not living for this world. And the Hebrew writer explains that, and he wanted us to know there is something better. That all these things, when you take your stand for God here, you might have a difficult time here. You might be made fun of at school. Your friends might think you're weird or strange because you want to go to services 3 times in a week instead of just 1 time on a Saturday, maybe like they go to, or whatever it is. But the Hebrew writer is saying, listen, this is not what this world, we're not living here for this world. There's something better coming. We skipped over some verses when we kind of read that by faith section. Let's go back to some of those verses in Hebrews 11, verses 12 through 16. It says, therefore, from one man, and him as good as dead, were born as many as the stars of the sky in multitude, innumerable as the sand which is by the seashore. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims of the earth. For those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland, and truly, if they had called to mind that country from which they had come out, they would have had opportunity to return. But now they desire a better, that is, a heavenly country. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. And then let's also skip down to verse 39. After he rattles off all these wonderful things that happen to people when they decide to take their stand in faith, he says, and all these, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not receive the promise, God having provided something better for us, that they should not be made perfect apart from us. What he's saying there is, and really in the context of Abraham, let's go back to the story of Abraham. God promised Abraham a lot, didn't he? Did Abraham see all of that come to fruition? No. No. In fact, Abraham, I don't want to say he had a bad life. I think he had a good life. But he spent most of his older life and his older years where most people would probably start settling down. He spent his life traveling because God told him to get up and travel, and I'm going to give this land. He spent 25 years of his life waiting on God to fulfill a promise of a son. And when that day finally did come, a couple, you know, about 13 years later, he was told to go sacrifice that son. I mean, Abraham's life was not all peachy. He didn't get to see the promises, all the promises. He got to see the son, and he got a glimpse of the promised land. But he didn't get to see all these descendants that we call the 12 tribes and the children of Israel that are still in that part of the world today. He didn't get to see all of them. The point the Hebrews writer is making here is his faith allowed him to follow God, even though the goal was not clearly seen. He couldn't see the end results, but God put something better there, which means there's something more. Abraham understood that. There's something more to this world. The Hebrew writer said, all these people have attained a good testimony, which means they've all done what they were supposed to do, but none of them received the promise. But what we understand now is there is heaven waiting for us. In verse 40, God having provided something better for us. I can honestly tell you that the parties and friends from high school don't matter. I told you yesterday, I can't remember the last time I talked to one of my friends in high school. And I know those kinds of things seem so important to young people right now because that's the world we live in. But what's more important? The party or the eternal glory? What's more important? Having fun now and suffering later or suffering a little bit now to have an eternal home of rest? What's going to be better for us in the long run? The things that are so important right now won't be important to you in a few years. I mean, I've seen that just in my short life here. I know many of you probably understand that better than I do. But what's important is that we're making sure we are going to receive a place in God's heavenly kingdom. And we need to understand that there is something greater here. When I take a stand for my faith, it might be difficult to do so now. The results might not be what I expect to receive, but there is something better coming. That when I take a stand now, I will get the reward later. And lastly, what we need to understand is, well, you can do this. God did not give us an impossible task here to stand up in our faith in this life. God did not give us something that he didn't think we could overcome. God, we've been talking about this week, and has been there for us, will be there for us, and when we turn to him, we can obtain that eternal glory. We can obtain that eternal home. Let's go on to chapter 12 in Hebrews, because, again, I was talking to some people about this the other day. Chapter 12, I think, is a horrible place to put that number 12. Whoever did the chapters and verses probably should have put that down a little bit lower, because there's a therefore right there. And when you read something and then it says therefore, don't stop reading. I always say, if there's a therefore, what's it there for, right? Many people stop at the end of chapter 11 and they say, look, we have all these great examples. Okay, great, that's fun. But chapter 12 finishes this thought up. He says there in verse 1, therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and he sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls. You know, when people read these verses, they get this idea of, because they say, since we're surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, and then immediately following, there's this this idea of a race being run. So the way people interpret this this verse is, there's this huge stadium, and all the past fathers of faith, if we want to call them, all the people we just read about in Hebrews chapter 11, they're all sitting in the stadium now watching us run this race, right? That's what people, we have such a great cloud of witnesses, they're all looking down at this race, watching us run this race, and they're just kind of cheering us on, saying, you can do this, you can go, go, go. That's not what that verse is saying. What this is saying is, the word witness means they've been through it. They've seen this. They've done this, right? When we say, oh, there was a witness at the crime scene, are we saying, oh, there was someone there watching the crime scene, cheering on, saying, you can do, go, go? No. It means that when you call a witness, here's someone that went through what happened. Here's someone that saw it. Here's someone that experienced it, and they can tell you what happened. That's what the Hebrew writer is trying to say here. We're surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses. All these people we just read about in Hebrews chapter 11, they can attest to the fact that there is something greater. They've run this race. They've been there. They've done that. And they've gotten through. And they're okay. Now, if you want to think they're cheering you on, great. That's fine. You know, a little encouragement can go a long way. But that's not what the writer's saying there. He's saying, these people have done it, so can you. Right? If these people and all the troubles and hardships that they've had in their lives, if they can stand up in the faith and they can remain faithful during all the things they had to go through, you can do it too, is what he's saying. And so he tells us, since we're surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, since we've seen that it can be done, let us lay aside the weight. Because we're now running this race, and it's pointless to run a race with the weight on us that we can't do this, right? And let us lay aside the sin which so easily ensnares us. Let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. If you're living this life and you're going through this life with sin on your back, you're not going to get very far. If you're, I mean, think about it. When I played football, our coach would hand us some ankle weights sometimes. And so when we were lifting in the weight room, we would just have a little bit of extra weight. And then we always came to a day called max day, where you just had to lift as much as you can. They kind of want to see how high you could get, you know, how big your numbers were. And so what we would do is we would take the ankle weights. We even had some on our wrists. And so we would take those weights off. And it's amazing that the weight you couldn't lift the day before with these extra weights on, you can lift a good, and I know this doesn't sound like much, but you can lift a good 5 to 10 pounds more, which is a lot when you're getting up there in numbers, you know. You can lift more when you just take off the extra weight. And because what you've done is you've trained yourself to get used to this weight on your wrists and your ankles. And then when you take it off, it's just easier. A lot of runners do that. They run with ankle weights so that, you know, they get used to running with, like, heavy feet. And when they take them off, they feel like they can go faster. A lot of soccer players, sprinters, a lot of people train that way. You kind of have that idea here, which is get that extra weight off. Get that sin out of your life. Get that weight off and run the race that is set before you. Looking unto Jesus. Again, another witness that has been through it and has done this. The author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and he sat down at the right hand of God, the throne of God. What we need to understand here again, and I say this all the time, Jesus never asks us to do something he's not willing to do himself. And that's just a perfect example right here. That Jesus, time and time again, we looked at this a few minutes ago, always told us to go and do, to go and do, to go and do. And that's an example we find throughout all the Bible. And here the Hebrew writer is making that same assessment we just looked at in Hebrews chapter 11. By faith, these people went and did something. Well, guess what? Jesus did the same thing. I think by faith, the author and finisher of our faith, that's just an extra little tag that Jesus gets that no one else had, right? When he saw the joy that was set before him, when he saw that end goal, when he saw that there's something better on the other side, what did he do? He endured. He despised the shame. And then he sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Which means Jesus, author and finisher of our faith, he put his faith into action. A lot of people, I've said that before, a lot of people, Jesus had to have faith. What? He was God. He didn't need faith. Remember when he was praying in the garden? He didn't want to go through the cross. He didn't want to go be tortured. He didn't want to do this. Do you think it took a little bit of faith to trust that when I get through with this, God has something better planned? I think so. That's why I think he's the author and finisher of our faith. He's been through this. He's done this. He wrote the book on what faith should look like, right? And Jesus was willing to do the same thing. And if Jesus can do it, and these other people can do it, we can do it too. And again, that's the point of verse 3, I think. For consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls. Again, Jesus never asked us to do anything he wasn't willing to do himself. I think he knew that being a Christian was not going to be the cool thing in high school and in college. I think he knew that at some point in the future, Christians were going to be ridiculed and mocked. And they especially were soon after here in the New Testament. Christians were being killed for calling on the name of Christ. But they say that if he can do it, consider him. Consider him that he had to endure the same thing. He had to endure hostility from sinners. He had to be mocked. He had to be ridiculed. He was probably called weird. You think of everything Jesus had to go through, he's not asking us to do any more than he was willing to do himself. And if he can do this, and the great cloud of witnesses from Hebrews chapter 11 and beyond can do this, we can too. We really have something to look forward to. Do not be discouraged, Hebrews 12 verse 3 says. Do not become weary and discouraged in your souls if your faith is tempted and tried at some time. Use those times to press forward and to press on. Our faith can help us get to our goal in heaven. 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 15, as we finish up here. 13. It says, "And who is he who will harm you if you become followers of what is good? But even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you are blessed, and do not be afraid of their threats, nor be troubled. But sanctify the Lord God in your hearts, and be always ready to give a defense to everyone who asks you a reason for the hope that is in you with meekness and fear." A lot of people think that when they say, "Be ready to give an answer for the hope that is among you," a lot of people take that and say you should be able to answer every question, Bible question that anyone ever asks you, and you should be ready with an answer. Name all 12 apostles, go. No, that's not what that verse is saying there, right? Because we're never going to, there's preachers that have been preaching for 50 years that still don't know everything, every biblical question, answer to every biblical question. What that's saying is you better be ready to give an answer for the hope that lies within you, which means You better have the faith in your heart. You better have that those convictions instilled now, so when someone does come and try to tempt you and try to steer you away from God, you can give them an answer for why you do what you do, for why you believe in God, for why you won't go to these certain places, for why you stand firm in your faith. You better be ready to give an answer for the hope that lies within you. You know what was going on in this time period with the New Testament Christians? They were being murdered, and they were being murdered brutally for calling on the name of Christ. Tacitus, he's a historian from this time period, he said that Christians were being burned and hung up on posts to serve as street lamps for passersby because they believed in Christ, because they gave an answer for their hope, because they stood strong in their faith. And Paul says, people should not persecute you for doing good, but if they do, you better be ready. And you better stand strong in your faith. You better be ready to give an answer for the hope that lies within you. I think Cassie was ready that day, don't you? At the Columbine shooting, I think she was ready to stand strong. I think she was ready to give an answer for her hope. Now, she met her demise. And I don't know how the judge, the gracious judge, will judge that. I don't know her background. I don't know what kind of person she was in her everyday life. But there is someone who was able to look death in the face, who was able to look sin and temptation in the face, and say, I still believe in God. I hope, as we exit this weekend, and as we look back on the things we've talked about sin and friends and family, that we can look sin in the face, and we can stand strong in our faith for Jesus Christ. I appreciate your time this morning. Our Bible class session is over. Before we close today, can I ask Derek to lead us in a closing prayer?